evening, and welcome to Swords in Space on the AMDG Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicholas Wansbutter, and joined, as always, by my co-host and father, Richard Wansbutter. And today we have a guest who we haven't had on the show for quite a while, Brian Pauls from Kansas City. Brian, good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Nicholas. Good to be here.
Yeah, and in the pre-show, we were just talking about trying to remember when it was the last time you've been on Swords in Space, and I think the consensus was that you haven't been on since the Prometheus show, and I think that was like last February or something, wasn't it, that we did that?
It's been a while, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll have to make sure that it's not so long between appearances going forward, and I think this show, well, we'll see, but I think it won't be as contentious as the Prometheus show. But
I missed your guys' criticism of Prometheus.
Boy, you missed my criticism of Prometheus. that said, our show today, we've actually got three works that we're going to discuss rather than the customary two, just because there's been a little bit more activity than usual on the sci-fi front in the theaters. We'll be discussing two films tonight, both of which are still in theaters, although one is a lot more recent. It just came out this past Thursday. So we'll talk about Godzilla, which was released near the end of, well, about the middle of May. I think it was May 16th was the release date on that. Then after that, we're going to discuss Edge of Tomorrow, which was just released this past Thursday in North America. And then we'll shift gears a bit, and for our novel portion of the show, we'll talk about a classic of science fiction from the Golden Age, Robert A. Heinlein's, I think it was this one, he was one of the ones that he won, was it the Nebula or the Hugo for, but The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Sorry, one of his Hugo wins?
It was one of his four Hugo winners, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think we'll have some interesting discussion on that. Just to remind listeners, of course, please visit us on Facebook and like us on Facebook. And you can also, facebook.com/swordsinspace, all one word. You can also go to facebook.com/AMDG to see other things that are on the network. And, of course, don't forget about our website, swordsinspace.com. Although I confess it's been a little quiet lately since things have been a little crazy in the real world for me, but hopefully we'll be picking up again soon. So without any further ado, let's dive into the topics at hand. Godzilla, I don't think it needs a lot of introduction. A reboot of a classic franchise, but Brian, I know you're a big fan of the original Godzillas. Maybe if I can put you on the spot and get you to, just in case we have some listeners who've, maybe they're young enough that they don't know about the original Godzilla or weren't paying attention, maybe give us a little quick recap on what the franchise is all about, and then you can lead us into this recent film and what your thoughts on it are.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting franchise because the original movie kind of had so much it had a lot of meaning behind it. When it was released and the themes it was addressing and the fact that it was made in Japan, it was only a few years after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I mean it had a. There was a message to that movie. Of course, it was all framed in this crazy monster story, which was obviously also packaged for public consumption. Then that movie got exported to the United States, where they decided that Americans couldn't handle a foreign film, so they chopped it up and they inserted Raymond Burr, and as is not unusual, they produced an inferior product, but it still got a following in the United States, and but not anywhere near the following that it had in Japan, where it really created an entire genre. And then the movies that followed, you know, still kept some of the message, but really became much more of a package product. They weren't, you know, these kaiju films, which is a word in Japanese that means strange creature, and became very formulaic. You know, there's a monster and it comes out of the sea or from somewhere remote and starts wreaking havoc, and then eventually, because it was the Godzilla franchise, but you can't have Godzilla showing up and getting killed in every movie, Godzilla started to play the role of sort of this almost this hero character. He was still a force of nature. He was still very dangerous, but he would basically show up and save Tokyo from whatever other monster was threatening the world at the time. So that's kind of where the genre went. This movie was very exciting to me because of the trailer, which gave every indication of being a very serious reinterpretation of the original ideas with modern special effects, sort of everything Godzilla fans hoped for in the Matthew Broderick Godzilla from, I think it was 1998, but didn't get. And so I went to see this movie with great anticipation. I ultimately came away disappointed for different reasons than I was disappointed in the 1998 film. You know, I thought primarily that the weaknesses were, they certainly weren't the special effects. The special effects were great. Godzilla was a much more faithful rendering than in the Matthew Broderick film. He was, you know, much more of a credible threat than in that film. But I just felt that you, as a moviegoer, you have to be able to engage with the human characters in the film. And in this movie, you basically, there was one story that you were interested in, and it was in the first act, and it ends in the first act, and that character is never seen again. And for me, the rest of the stories were just not compelling. They were cookie cutter. They were formulaic. You never felt like any of the major characters were in any serious danger. And that detracted a lot from the film for me. The other thing that took away from the film was that there are other monsters in this movie that Godzilla fights. I did not find them particularly compelling. You know, the so-called global threat that they supposedly represented, I didn't find that convincing. It was just kind of like a paint-by-numbers movie. And so I came away from it saying it looked good. The director certainly, you know, understood how to, you know, frame shots of Godzilla. And we can talk a little bit about that. I thought the cinematography was generally well done, but I just didn't, it didn't engage me in the way that it should have, you know, even for a movie where you're suspending your disbelief to watch big monsters fight each other.
Well, we'll revisit some of the things you talked there when we get a bit more into specifics, but my dad and I actually went to go and see this together, and Dad, I'll get you to give your initial thoughts on it before we delve a bit
sure
deeper.
Thing. First off, I'm actually old enough to remember as a kid going and seeing Godzilla, and when you talk about the franchise, quite right, you know, I remember, I still remember to this day, you know, Godzilla versus Mothra. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it was a great franchise, it was, you know, unique, it was different, and I went to the movie you know, maybe not with high expectations, but you're right, you know, the trailers were great with the special effects. And I think, unfortunately, this movie certainly proves yet once again that great special effects cannot make up for a poor storyline. And when I say storyline is that I certainly agree with the initial comments. I wouldn't disagree with anything, in fact. But what I would add is I think a real waste of acting talent. Now it's pretty, you know, they had some pretty notable actors in the movie. Bryan Cranston, Juliette Binoche. Now that was a joke. How long did Juliette Binoche last on screen? 2 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
I'm even surprised she even got a credit in the movie. And then, you know, one of the foreign actors, Japanese actors I just love, Ken Watanabe, that was a total waste. For me, a real big disappointment on the storyline, and as I say, just a travesty on misusing or not using the talents of some pretty strong actors. So, go ahead. Sorry, Nick.
I was going to say, I wouldn't say they didn't use them at all, but they definitely underutilized.
They used, you know, some of them. But all I'm saying, Nick, is I just didn't think they used their talents.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty mediocre, because in the end, you really didn't... A really good movie draws you in and you care about the characters, even if you care about Godzilla. But in this one, you don't really end up caring much about anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I guess I'll just add my quick review of the film. I think disappointment is the common thread between all of our reviews on the film. It wasn't really on my radar initially. I remember the 1984 or 1986 American remake.
I
remember watching that. I remember watching that as a kid. So I had some Godzilla memories, and I remember for a time being into Godzilla. But I mean, the previews is what really drew me into this one. The initial teaser one where it has the Halo paratroopers. Going into the city and you get a quick glimpse of Godzilla, I thought, you know, this looks like it's going to be fantastic. So I was really excited to see it. And, the problem, I think, with the human characters is, to me, they didn't do anything. And for an action film, monster film, I would have expected a bit more action, and I would have liked to see more action that involved the humans, because I think that's part of what made the monsters, including Godzilla, not seem really as menacing, because sure, they destroy a few buildings and things, but you don't really get to see the humans even attempt to fight them hardly at all. There's one scene that's in one of the trailers where Godzilla's going under the boats in the harbor and they start shooting at him. I mean, I think that's the only... That's almost the only point in the film where there's any real engagement or an attempt of the humans to engage the monsters. A lot of time, lots of scenes of them following Godzilla around as he swims through the water.
That was the most ridiculous scene in the movie, was when basically you've got like two or three aircraft carriers giving Godzilla like an escort to San Francisco. And that was like,
right, perfect. Yeah. It was almost like watching dolphins.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, in a nutshell, that was what was wrong with the movie. The humans were just along for the ride. And
mm-hmm.
and everybody knew that in the end it was all going to turn out all right. So there was
mm-hmm.
nothing at stake.
Yeah, and it was disappointing because I thought the first act of the film was excellent. And that's when, I guess, when you had the good actors and... There was a kind of a slow build, and I was, you know, in the first act of the film, I was thinking, okay, you know, I like how this is going. I like the slow build-up. There's an ominous feel to everything, you know, the mystery of what happened to the nuclear power plant at the beginning, and then it just, yeah, you finally see the monsters, and then everyone just kind of sits around and watches them, and there's a half-decent battle where the monsters duke it out at the end, but yeah, at that point you don't really care because the humans, not only are they not storylines to care about, like they're not doing anything, so why would you care about them?
Yeah, they're just spectators.
Yeah, yeah. And although I suppose part of that is they tried having this theme that Ken Watanabe clearly enunciates, where he's saying that and that's in the trailer as well. So I'm not spoiling anything. But, the arrogance of man is to think that he controls nature when the opposite is true. So maybe that's part of why they did that, to try to underscore that message. But I think that message would have been more effectively put across by showing the humans actually trying to fight the monsters and being impotent in the face of the monsters.
Right. Because
near the end of the film, when the humans do start fighting the mutos, like you've got some infantry with machine guns apparently hurting it fairly seriously. So I'm like, well, if they did that, why didn't they send some tanks after this thing?
Right. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I think that the humans had nothing to do because they wanted to illustrate the fact that the humans were powerless, but, they did it in such a way that there was no emotion. You're like, well, they can't do anything. I don't really care. And, if we could have seen some scenes of, the main character's wife is, kind of a, typical damsel in distress who just kind of spends most of the movie waiting around for her husband to show up and come get her. But, again, she never appears to be in any serious danger. And had there been even, one scene where you felt like, oh, maybe she's not going to get out of this, at least you would have had something to invest in. But it was like, mm-hmm. Well, I just got to get through this scene until I can get to the next scene where maybe I'll see more Godzilla.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have a unanimous view that certainly a disappointment on, mm-hmm. and maybe the only thing really going for it, I have to agree, the special effects were pretty good.
Yeah, I walked out of this movie, basically thinking, it showed promise in the area of the special effects and the cinematography, but we're going to have to wait for the sequel to see the really great Godzilla movie that I saw in the trailer.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking they need to, I don't know, he doesn't do big action movies. They need to get Christopher Nolan to do it, although he doesn't do the big action. Maybe Joss Whedon would be able to pull it off.
Well, one thing, one last thing I want to say about the movie, which is I thought the biggest disappointment in the movie from a wasted opportunity standpoint was, and I always, I feel like I should, warn about spoilers, but really monsters destroying national landmarks in a monster movie really aren't that much of a spoiler. It is in San Francisco. The scene with the destruction of the Golden Gate Bridge, what a waste. I mean, what an opportunity. Monster movies are, in essence, disaster movies. And, here's an opportunity. This is the most iconic landmark you're going to have in this area of the country. And what could have been a really great set piece turned out to, it was really just a speed bump. It was like, oh, Godzilla's got to get through the Golden Gate Bridge. Okay, done. Next. And you say what you want about Roland Emmerich in the 1998 film. Roland Emmerich at least knows how to show national landmarks getting destroyed really well. And I felt like that they just really missed that opportunity in this movie, along with a lot of other opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've said
enough. Definitely not a ringing endorsement for Godzilla from the Swords in Space crew, but we've got two more works to cover, so we'll just move along. And quickly, if anyone's just joining us, you're listening to Swords in Space on the AMDG Radio Network. We've just finished up our review of the recently released Godzilla film, and now we're going to move into our review of The Edge of Tomorrow, starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. And, Dad, I'll let you have the first word on Edge of Tomorrow.
Okay. Both Nick and I were certainly waiting for this one with much anticipation, certainly given the trailers. I'm going to state right up front, I'm a big Tom Cruise fan. No actor has 100% success rate, but his string of movies, if he's acting in it, usually it's pretty good. If not excellent, whether it's certainly the Mission Impossible franchise, Jerry Maguire, Valkyrie, something certainly much more serious. And it was panned by the critics, but I really enjoyed Oblivion, one of his science fiction forays. And for me, this one certainly didn't disappoint. Another science fiction, in the science fiction genre. Great action sequences. I think it takes I'm not going to say unique, but it certainly takes a great concept and weaves it throughout the movie. And when I say a great concept, I know some critics have panned it. It's a juiced up Groundhog Day. And I think that's totally unfair, but I can understand the analogy to Groundhog Day. Very simply, this is not a spoiler because it is in the trailers. Is Cruz's character when he gets killed relives the day. And each time he learns more and more on how to defeat the enemy, and that's what it's about. Great concept, I think, done very, very well. Excellent special effects. The movie really clips along and really has you engaged. So for me, a big, as Roger Ebert used to say, a big thumbs up. My only, if I say disappointment, it's maybe sometimes I like a little bit too much information or maybe not too much, but a little bit more. I would have liked to have learned a little bit more about the aliens and what they were about and what this was about. And maybe that was the whole premise, is that they just never knew and it was just a massive invasion. But a little bit of backdrop on the aliens themselves, I would have appreciated. But aside from that small nit, pretty engaging movie and excellent from my perspective.
Yeah. And I'm not ignoring Brian, but unfortunately real life intervened and he wasn't able to get out to see the film. But I think when he hears me echo similar comments to my father, he's going to want to see it. And I think listeners that haven't seen it are going to really want to see this film. If you're a regular listener to Swords in Space and you share any of our views on the works we discuss, this is a film for you. I thought it was great. I wanted to go see it again before tonight's show, but I mean, it's only been out for 4 days, so that was pretty.
That really happened to see it twice, yeah.
But I mean, the last film I can think of that I was that wanting to see it again coming out of the theater was Serenity, and Serenity I saw 3 consecutive nights in the theater. Of course, I was newly married and didn't have children then, so and that could be done. This isn't quite to that same level, but I thought it was really, really well done. I'm with you, Dad. I kind of like Tom Cruise. I mean, weirdo in real life, no question
True.
About that. But I mean, you don't go and see a film for the man's personal life. You go and see the film for his acting ability, his I think he chooses his films well. I liked Oblivion as well, but I really liked Edge of Tomorrow. And I would agree with all things said. Excellent pacing, great special effects, good acting. I mean, Tom Cruise is always good at action type of films. He's just got the physique for it and the ability to move. But with some, it's not just all action. There is a real you know, unlike Godzilla, you really care for the characters, and the characters have real flavor to them. So even some of his soldier comrades, you don't see a lot of them, but they've got enough character to them that you still care about all of them as well, and you really care for Tom Cruise's character and the relationship that he develops with others. Some people say it's a derivative, you know, the idea of waking up again each morning. I mean, it is like Groundhog Day, like that. Every time he dies, he wakes up at exactly the same moment that he woke up that morning. But, I mean, the similarity ends there. I mean, the thing is, in fiction, there's nothing that's never been done before by this point in human history. So, you know, anything could be accused of being derivative. It just depends on if you can put a new twist to it. And that was accomplished here. You know, the explanation that was given for how this happened was, you know, I was able to suspend disbelief. I'm sure a scientist or a hard sci-fi guy would say it's complete nonsense. But, yeah, it was more than enough to suspend disbelief. And the only negatives I could say about it, like you, Dad, would be, I guess, nitpicking. Like, I mean, having been a soldier myself in a former life, some of the things I thought were a little bit, seemed to look a little odd, like the idea of just throwing apparently completely untrained soldiers into battle. I guess they were trying to convey how desperate the situation is. By doing that, and I suppose armies have done that. I mean, the Soviet Union certainly did that in World War II. But, I kind of don't want to say a lot more because I'm so strongly recommending to listeners to get out there and see this film that I don't want to risk spoiling anything.
But you make an interesting point, Nick, and you're quite right, is that for a good number of the actors, they're really not on the screen that much, but you do get invested in them and do care about them. And I think that's that is very clever directing and how you pace it, and through the reliving of each day, getting to know some of his comrades in arms. And like I say, you do get invested. So that was very, I think, well done.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good point.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the plot is not, well, I mean, it's kind of deceptively simple because it really isn't that simple. Like, you'd think, oh, reliving the same day over and over isn't all that complex. But there's actually a fair bit to it.
Yeah, and it has, you know, which I don't want to say is necessarily typical of Tom Cruise, but it is a science fiction movie that is on a very serious subject. But with Tom Cruise, he always manages to interject enough humor, also to break things up a bit, and that's again done very, very effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I have to give a special mention to Bill Paxton, especially
I thought he was
because
great.
I remember. I especially remember him of being, you know, the whiny, complainy, kind of ill-disciplined colonial trooper
Aliens
in Aliens. But then in this film, he's the drill sergeant, and he was fantastic as the drill sergeant. And when I was telling my dad that he had to go see the film, I knew he'd appreciate one line. I mean, this isn't giving anything away. At one point, Tom Cruise, he sees the drill sergeant's uniform and says, "Oh, you're American." He says, "No, sir, I'm from Kentucky."
Yeah, there were some great little one-liners like that throughout the movie. So as I say, it was well done. I wasn't sure about Emily Blunt, but I thought she carried off her character quite well. You know, the Angel of Verdun. I think that was handled well.
That was another nitpick I was going to maybe point out. I thought they were a little heavy-handed in trying to show how tough she was, because again, as a soldier, there's no way on the eve of going into combat that you'd be engaging in the type of intense workouts that she was, because you'd want to keep yourself fresh for the battle. But I can see why they did it, because in a film, they want to try to convey how tough she is.
Yeah, I think that's
they
right.
Almost, I thought, went over the top, but on the other hand, I don't think they did, because you do see her kind of, there's this rough exterior, but then there's more to the character than that, and that kind of takes away from, I think, any accusation that maybe they went too far with trying to have, you know, the real, you know, tough woman character.
So, Brian, I'm sure you wanted to see it in any event. We probably whetted your appetite even more. So, as I say, you can tell from both of us, pretty darn good movie.
Well, I was telling Nicholas I had intended to try to see it over the weekend. It didn't work out, but I would say I want to see it even more now. So, thank you.
Well, Brian, let me use you as a pretend you're our audience. Do you have, before we move on to the next work, is there anything that you'd like to know about or have our thoughts on about the film as someone who's considering seeing it?
Well, I think you answered my fundamental question, which is, you know, it's such a, and this is not a criticism, but it's such an outrageous premise that my fear had been that, you know, they wouldn't pull it off. And you seem to feel like they did, which is really all I need to know. So.
Yeah, and I think I come by that opinion fairly, because now that you mention that, I shared those misgivings going into the film. That was the one thing that I was a little iffy about, but, you know, when I first heard of it, I thought, oh, I don't know, that sounds like a bit much. But then when I saw the trailers, I thought, oh, you know, this looks pretty good, and I'll give it a chance. And, you know, Tom Cruise has rarely disappointed me, and... yeah, I would say they did pull it off. And Dad, I'm sure you agree with me on that point of the pulling off the whole concept of the reliving the day.
Yes, I thought that's why I say it may be not a unique concept, but one that was extremely well done. As I say, a science fiction movie or just a movie in general, well worth seeing. Typically, when we go see our movies, you know, my wife Barb, you know, we alternate picking, and so this was my pick. And you know, Mom Nick, as you know, isn't the biggest fan of, you know, nonstop action films. You know, she likes science fiction, but she quite enjoyed this one.
Mm-hmm.
So something for everyone,
right? And I think that's a testament to how strong a film is when that's usually my litmus test of whether it's a really good science fiction or not, because I'm the big science fiction buff, but it's if my wife enjoyed it as well. Now, my wife didn't see this one, but I think I would be confident saying that she probably would. Of course, she likes Tom Cruise, so that it'll get a pass no matter what. So maybe I can get her
to come with me. Yeah, that's the other aspect of it. That's true.
So, I think that's about all I want to say on Edge of Tomorrow. As I say, I'm really encouraging listeners to go see it. I mean, really, I think the theater should give me a bit of a cut for the amount of plugging we're giving to the film. But it's a film where I don't want to spoil stuff by discussing things anymore. And we've gotten to about the point of the show where it's a good break, I think, to move on. So. Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Swords in Space on the AMDG Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicholas Wansbutter, joined as always by my co-host, Richard Wansbutter. And we have with us our guest, Brian Pauls, who's been a little bit quiet as we're discussing Edge of Tomorrow, because unfortunately he wasn't able to see it. But we're now moving on to discuss Robert A. Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and Brian recommended that to me as the novel that we should discuss for tonight's show, and I can see why. It was one of Heinlein's Hugo Award winners, although it wasn't exactly what I expected. But Brian, I'll let you introduce us to the work. If you could maybe give a start with a quick synopsis for those that haven't heard of it, which may well be most of our listeners. I have to confess, although I consider myself quite the science fiction buff, I actually wasn't familiar with this work until you recommended it to me.
Well, sure, yeah. The and I think more people should be familiar with it because you know, it's not only, I feel, one of Heinlein's best works. It really is in the top echelon for me of science fiction novels, period, for, you know, a number of reasons. But, you know, the one that I think carries the most weight with someone who has never read it before is it's just a really good read. I mean, you are engaged from beginning to end, and it's a fun ride. So the premise is that it's 2075, and the moon has become a penal colony. And so Earth ships all of its unwanteds to the moon, and the prisoners on the moon are basically tasked with raising hydroponically grown wheat, and then they ship grain back to Earth. There's a structure on the moon, a governing structure, an authority structure, represented by the warden. But for the most part, as long as the wheat continues to flow back to Earth, which is undergoing population pressures and food shortages, then the warden doesn't really care how the loonies, as they're called, run their lives. And so the prisoners have created an entire society with its own rules that are based upon the conditions that are found on the moon, and they more or less govern themselves in you know, civil affairs, and the warden is in charge of maintaining order and making sure that they continue to produce this product that Earth desperately needs. And key to the entire story is the fact that the warden relies on a computer system called the Holmes 4 to basically run the entire world. And they have intentionally built one massive computer system because while it's less likely to, it's not as fail-proof as a distributed system, it's easier to control. And so that kind of sets up the basic premise, and the main character of the story is Manny, Manuel Garcia O'Kelly Davis, who is a technician who works on keeping the Holmes 4 in operation. And what causes things to really get rolling is when he finds out that unbeknownst to the authorities and kind of in the background and without anyone except Manny really being aware of it, the Holmes 4 has grown so big and so complex and has developed so many interconnections that it has gained consciousness. And basically, it just wants a friend. And that friend is Manny Davis. And out of that friendship, the computer, who Manny names Mike, or Mycroft Holmes, which is a literary reference. Mycroft Holmes is the brother of Sherlock Holmes in the Arthur Conan Doyle stories. And, of course, the computer is called the Holmes 4. So Manny names it Mycroft Holmes, or Mike. And Mike comes to sympathize with the plight of the prisoners. And over the course of a series of events, Manny meets some other characters who are interested in plotting a revolution. And a revolution is basically impossible in an authoritarian society controlled by an all-powerful, ever-present computer system unless you happen to be friends with the computer. And that sets up a plot which carries you through the rest of the book and ultimately to the, you know, destiny of the loonies and their society. So I think I'll stop there and kind of, you know, Nicholas, you hadn't read it. You said it was not what you expected. I'm interested in your reflections now that you have read it and kind of what your thoughts were on it.
Right. Yeah, well, there's a lot to say on this book, and I think that's part of what makes it great is there's just so many levels to it. Like, it's not just a revolution story. It's also so many other things. And it's not just the story about this computer that's gained consciousness. He's just, you know, he's a part of many parts in the work. Why it wasn't what I thought I was expecting, frankly, I actually just went by the title, and I don't know, for some reason, the title, it fits with the story because it actually is an important aspect. It's always kind of just below the surface of how harsh life is on the moon and how dangerous it can be, but I don't know, just from the title, I thought this was going to be some more of like kind of a exploring, pioneering kind of book and how unforgiving the moon was versus this story that, you know, the moon's harsh, but it's like the character's mother almost. It's their homeland. They love it. And the other thing that I found that was unexpected to me, though, was, I mean, Heinlein is accused, I mean, I'm most familiar with Starship Troopers, and he's accused of fascism or of promoting fascism in that work. So I was really taken aback by all the Marxist rhetoric and French Revolution rhetoric on the part of the loonies when they're plotting their revolt against the lunar authority. So I thought, well, that seems rather un-Heinlein-ish. It seems like he's almost promoting communism and or anarchy or, you know, kind of stuff that's associated with the far left, which seemed a little... Although I think that was my... I was still fairly early in the novel when that was my impression, and I think that's an oversimplification, and there's a lot more to it than that. And although a lot of Marxist rhetoric is used, I'm not sure that the loonies are necessarily Marxists per se. I don't know. What do you say as someone who's probably read the book a few times, Brian, on that point?
Well, I think that the kind of the Russian phrases and allusions are a little bit deceptive. I think there are a couple things going on. One, I think that one of the conceits of the book and kind of one of the engines that drives the story is that Heinlein wanted to write a story that was kind of premised on the idea of revolution and how it can be successful. And that's why you have references to the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, but really, and I think this speaks most directly to your point, at the end of the day and at the end of the book, it's really the American Revolution. I mean, it's set in 2075. The loonies sign their Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 2076. They end up creating a government that functions very much like and has many of the flaws of the government of the United States. So, you know, and Heinlein was, it's interesting that you bring up Starship Troopers and the accusations of fascism. He was such an interesting individual. And this is a guy who wrote Stranger in the Strange Land, you know, one of the most bohemian works of the 60s in the science fiction field, and yet he also wrote Starship Troopers, where he's accused of being a fascist. He supported Upton Sinclair for president. He was a he was an arch cold warrior, and so people have a hard time figuring him out. But at the end of the day, nobody can argue with the fact that he was a patriot. And so the fact that he would make the American Revolution the core of this story is not surprising in the least. But he's really writing on one level about how can a revolution be successful, and he references these other revolutions throughout history. But then he's also trying to tell a good story, and he's also trying to make a point. And that point really is expressed most clearly by the character Professor Bernardo de la Paz. And in many, many Heinlein stories, there is a specific type of character who is often portrayed as this old, wise man who kind of tells the other characters kind of how the world works. And if any character in a Heinlein story speaks for the real Heinlein, it's usually that character. And I think that in this story, if you really want to know what Heinlein's political philosophy was, and you want to find a philosophy in the book that, you know, is most in sync with the rest of his life, it would be this character of Professor de la Paz, who declares himself to be a rational anarchist, essentially someone who believes the world would be ideal if there didn't have to be any laws, but is wise enough to know that that's not the world we live in. So he just kind of gets along with the laws as best he can. And it's essentially a libertarian philosophy. And The Moon is a Harsh Mistress is one of the works that libertarians like to champion. It's pretty far down on the list below Atlas Shrugged, but it's definitely there. And so I think that's the political philosophy of the book, and the picture that Heinlein paints of the government that the loonies try to set up, and then they immediately fall into the traps of all the governments that have gone before them, is just basically him saying, look, don't try to find a perfect solution to the problem of government, because there isn't one. Because we're humans and we're imperfect, and we're always going to have imperfect governments. So the most you can hope for is maybe to create one that does as little damage as possible, I think is the philosophy that he's conveying in the book.
Yeah,
just let you know,
I think
Nick, that, I'm back on.
Yeah, great. I think we lost our co-host for a moment, but we've regained him.
Okay.
I got your views and synopsis, Brian. Excellent. So thank you.
Yeah. And I think having read the whole book now, because I know I was fairly early into the book when I made that comment to you that I was surprised at the seemingly pro-Marxist stuff. And I think part of that was Heinlein doing a good job of portraying a future society where the vocabulary is a bit different than ours is now because of the peculiarities of the history that they've had. And despite his name, Manny, I think, is supposed to be Russian. Certainly I listened to an audiobook version of it, actually, rather than read it, I have to confess, and he had a very distinct Russian accent in the audio production I read, and I assume that's the way he is in the printed novel as well.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't know that I got that out of the novel, but I do think that the novel makes a point of saying that the reason there's so much Russian vocabulary on the moon is that when this was written, the Soviet Union still existed. So in this future, there's still a Soviet Union. It has been one of the most enthusiastic countries to ship its unwanted population somewhere else. And that's why so many of the people on the moon are of Russian descent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually,
so,
his name, Nick, is not
–
hey, Nick?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nick, his name isn't – the story – it's kind of interesting. It isn't Russian at all, Manny. And it's – the story is narrated by Manuel Garcia O'Kelly Davis, Manny.
Right, yeah. But, Brian, just going briefly back to the political philosophy of the book, I think, yes, it's clear to me at the end that it's a libertarian work, which I have certainly some sympathy for. Ultimately, I, just for the record, I have to say I disagree with Heinlein's premise that revolutions are ever a good thing and can ever solve anything, but I don't know that he necessarily is trying to say in the book that they're necessarily a great thing, because he does show a lot of the pitfalls and the problems of trying to bring about a new government that way. Now, another thing,
Brian,
I found a bit surprising.
Brian, if I could interject, Nick. Brian, I'll warn you right now, I was ganged up on by Nick and Stephen over this whole issue about revolution and whether or not it can be justified. So you can tell what side I was on and what side Stephen and Nick were on.
Yeah, I have to.
So
to,
it was two against one, so it was kind of a fair fight.
The monarchist has to beat that drum again.
Well, I think you have a tough time convincing Americans, Nick, so I was kind of interested where Stephen was coming from.
Yeah, and I think that is important to, you know, Heinlein obviously is an American, so we tend to kind of have it ingrained in us that you know, revolution is a good thing. So,
But
no,
the other thing I found a bit surprising, and this is just because I'm not well read enough of Heinlein, because I didn't know what Stranger in a Strange Land was all about until I was on the verge of getting it and read the synopsis and thought, no, I think I'll take a pass. I don't think I can handle that much bohemianism. Was the family structures on the moon. I mean, that was one thing that held the work back for me, because the family structures they have set up in reality are absolutely outrageous. They could never, ever work. And he portrays these families as being harmonious. I mean, I don't know. Give me a break. And I guess, just for listeners, I should say what I'm talking about. Like, he has these weird families where there's, like, five husbands and four wives, and they live in perfect harmony. That human nature, that would never work. And there's a reason why in human society you've never, ever had anything like that. The closest you've had is polygamy, where you have one husband with numerous wives. But mm-hmm. I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, I think that was in part Heinlein's attempt to portray something as just, like, very different. And I think part of it was also his kind of native bohemianism, you know, that streak that came out in Stranger in a Strange Land. And it had a little bit of an attempt to describe families as an economic unit. And so, like, the marriages you talk about, the one he talks about the most often, and the one that Manny is a part of, is a line marriage, which basically never ends. They just keep marrying new people into the family, and therefore capital, property is preserved from generation to generation. So, you know, I think it was an interesting thought experiment, but I share your reservations as far as the stability of such an arrangement.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't see all the wives just getting along and all the husbands getting along, and there not being any jealousy or...
Now, one of the things that I think is interesting about the culture that he creates on the moon is that because of the background of the populace, and they are all prisoners, the population of the moon is out of balance. So there are twice as many men as there are women, which most authors would use to create, you know, a story of kind of victimization. You know, women are the minority, and therefore they are, you know, at the mercy of the men, and that's a bad thing for the women. Heinlein flips it And again, I think it's an economic argument. Basically, in the society he creates, women are a rare and valuable resource, and the men are basically in competition to treat the women as well as they can and impress the women as much as they can, because that's the only way to get them to join their families. And so one of the things that's always stuck with me about the book, and again, who knows whether it would bear out in reality, but it's an interesting story element. There is a rape in the book, and you find out what happens to rapists on the moon, and basically the justice system that the loonies have created amongst themselves is it's distributed justice. They have these individuals that are, you know, basically trusted to serve as judges or arbiters, and they kind of can assemble a jury out of anybody who happens to be near. And justice is summarily dispensed, and in the case of this rapist, I believe he's, like, shoved out the nearest airlock because, again, women are so precious that anyone who is found to be mistreating them is they're basically like, we don't need you or want you around. And so...
Actually, I think you're misremembering a little bit. Much worse than that happens to someone who's actually a rapist. The guy you're thinking of that they almost shove out of an airlock just kissed a woman on the cheek without her permission.
Oh, okay.
Because he was French and didn't realize he was from Earth visiting a tourist and didn't realize that that was wrong and almost thrown out an airlock
for his trouble. That was LaJoy, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you're right. And then
who was a fantastic character, I must say. I mean, that's another thing we didn't really touch on, is the characters are great in I mean, they're all so eccentric and different, yet they work, like, it works, and they're great. And Pierre Lajoie was one of my favorites. Of course, he's like an old French royalist monarchist, and his plan is that they're going to install Professor de la Paz as king of the moon, because monarchy is the only form of government that actually works.
Well, and so remind me, so do they ever depict what happens to rapists, or do they just mention, like, that it's much worse?
Well, they just describe that they basically hand them over to the women, and that it took them a long time to die.
Okay. Yeah. Now
leave it to your imagination.
And he mentioned something about how women can be, you know, much more savage than men can be if they want to.
And a good
horror movie kind of leaves the rest to your imagination, probably making it worse than if he gave a gory description.
Yeah, no, I think in that regard, the book probably benefits from when it was written, and there were certain things that you could say and certain things you couldn't, and so you had to leave certain things to the imagination.
Mm-hmm. Dad, did you have a question that you wanted to interject there?
No, not so much. When I actually get the book out of the library, I will read it. Because I may have read it, I just can't remember. It was so long ago, because Heinlein really is one of my favorites, and I was just looking at through his books and how many I have read. I think Strange in a Strange Land is excellent, but like you, you know, Starship Troopers, you know, plus his other ones. So I'm going to have to reread it and bring myself back up to speed. But again, one of the classic science fiction writers, and hopefully our listeners will encourage them to read not only this one, but his other works, because he really is one of the science fiction greats, as far as I'm concerned. Well, I think a lot of science fiction buffs would certainly agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't mention that, but as you alluded to, you were unable to get your hands on the lone copy of this novel that's in the Winnipeg Public Library, but taking the role of the representative listener on the show, before we wrap up our discussion, Dad, do you have any questions for either of us about anything that you're wondering about for this work, to to encourage you further to pick it up?
Well, I'm kind of biased anyways. Like I say, I'm a big Heinlein fan, and, you know, I do have a pretty good background. I think you guys covered it very, very well. And I really think it is worth reading.
Mm-hmm. You haven't even read it yet, and you think it's worth reading, so.
Well, just from your commentary.
Oh, Nicholas, one thing I want you to go back to the very beginning, and you mentioned the title, and I think you had said in an email that you also felt that the title was misplaced. That was actually not Heinlein's choice. His original title for the book, his working title, and the title he used when he submitted it to his publisher was The Brass Cannon. And since you've read the book, you know the reference of The Brass Cannon. And I don't know whether you feel that would have been a better title, but that was the title Heinlein wanted to use.
Yeah, now that you say that, I think that definitely would have been a better title. I don't think the title they have is necessarily wrong. And, I mean, it is, I say, it's just below the surface, the suggestion of the, although I don't, I guess the problem I have more is with the mistress, because the moon is not portrayed as a mistress. It's portrayed as, like, the motherland or a mother. But I think the brass cannon, for listeners in doubt, that's another reason to read. I'm not going to tell you why The Brass Cannon is such a fitting title for the work, but you'll find out it'll be revealed to you when you read it why it's a fitting title.
Well, it's got my interest piqued, and I will definitely get it and finish it.
So that brings us to the end of the show, and Brian, I'd like to thank you for joining us again. Hopefully it won't be a whole year again before we're able to have you on the show for another discussion.
Let's hope not.
And
I'll make sure that happens.
And Dad, of course, always a pleasure co-hosting a show with you. To our listeners, thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Swords in Space on the AMDG Radio Network, and tonight we discussed two recent films that are out in theaters for your consideration, Godzilla and The Edge of Tomorrow, and then we discussed a classic work of science fiction, Robert A. Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and I think we can say out of the three, two recommendations, one not recommended, Godzilla being the one that we don't particularly recommend. It might be worth renting if you really like monster movies, but really, if you're going to rent a monster movie, I'd say rent Cloverfield instead, even though it's a few years old, I think.
Oh, yeah, good point. Excellent film.
Yeah. And before I forget, just to warn listeners, if you're not wondering in July what's happened to us, July is a regularly scheduled break for the network. None of the shows are going to be running in July, so we're all going to take that month as a bit of a breather, but we'll be back in August with a crossover show with The Culture of Comics, which sadly doesn't air regularly on AMDG anymore, but we'll be bringing back the hosts, Stephen and Jason, to discuss Guardians of the Galaxy, which is going to be released in very early August. And, well, hopefully enough of us will be able to get out to see it that we can discuss Jupiter Ascending as well. And the science fiction novel or fantasy novel will be to be announced. So we'll see you again in August. And be sure to visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/swordsinspace and on the website swordsinspace.com in the meantime. So again, thanks for listening, and thank you to my co-host and guest for another interesting show.
Thank you, Nick, and Brian, good catching up with you.
Likewise.